Thanks for the invitation. As you could guess from this first slide, this is something we did some time ago. There's still USC there, so it's an old slide. And I guess the title is also old. We change it later on. It's a talk which is going to present, is based on two papers. One is a theoretical paper finding a formula for the optimal filter when estimating volatility from observed stock prices. And the other is a numerical paper implementation of that theory. Both of them have been published this year or last year, one in Analysis of Applied Probability, the other one is General Computational Finance. So the first one is joint with Litzer and Rozovsky, and Rozovsky is also no longer at USC, he's at Brown now. And the second one is joined with Rozovsky and Ilya Zelyapin, who is no longer at UCLA, actually. So this is completely wrong, except for Litzer, in terms of affiliations. So what do we want to do here? So the motivation is to situation in which you observe possibly high-frequency stock prices data, and you want to estimate the current value of volatility. Okay, so it's not prediction, it's just the current value of volatility. We are going to assume that volatility may change maybe frequently too, and want to, so it's a filtering problem really, mathematically speaking. That's what we do in terms of the methodology. What is kind of new here, which is not a standard filtering problem, is that we are going to assume that the observations, so that we have a continuous process for the stock prices, however, the observations are at discrete times, and those times can be random. Okay, something like Poisson jumps between times. So it's a pretty general in that regard. And then in a special case, when we assume that the volatility is a Markov chain process, continuous time Markov chain, we will do the numerical implementation. And then we did some tests on simulated data and a couple of companies, real data for IBM and General Electric, and then they'll just illustrate what happens. We never tried to make money out of this. I don't know if anybody else did. So as a disclaimer here, if you try to use this, lose money, we are not at fault there. So the motivation came from some previously existing literature. Elliot and others looked at a similar problem, but in a discrete time model, and without random time between observations. And then pretty much the same problem that we looked at was looked at by Frey and Rungaldir, but they had a relatively complex numerical procedure to find to do the filtering, the estimation. We were able to get pretty much explicit equations for filtering, so it's faster and it's more efficient. Then there is other maybe more popular approaches, modeling and estimating volatility, like Arch-Gauge literature or just using maximum likelihood or quadratic variation literature. So that we don't really compare, didn't do comparison with those literature, I'm just mentioning as alternative approaches. So here's the model. Model is a kind of a generalized Black-Scholes, except the volatility is going to be random. So there's some factor theta there. So these are log prices. X is the notation for the log price. There is a factor theta which drives the volatility, V of theta, and maybe the drift mu of theta. Drift is not going to be our main concern here, partly because it's much harder to estimate than volatility. B is a Brian motion. So it's a Black-Scholes except stochastic volatility. And one big assumption that we make, and not necessarily very realistic, is that the theta process is independent of the Brownian motion, so there is an independence between the volatility and the stock price in a way. But there are some people at my former colleagues at USC, Mikulajevicius and his students, trying to generalize these results to the case of when you have more dependence between different processes here. So there will be random observation times, tau k, which we have pretty much no assumptions on the distribution of these random times. Although in the numerical implementation, we will have some basically exponential times. And the underlying volatility process in the general theory can be also pretty general in terms of some diffusion process, maybe some jumps too. But in the numerical paper, we did a continuous time Markov chain as the underlying theta process. Okay, so that's the general model. And in order to state the main results, we need a little bit heavy notation, but this is the best we could do. So first of all, if you condition on knowing theta, you basically have a Black-Scholes model. So if you know theta, then the density of the log prices is going to be a normal distribution, this rho, with the mean m and the variance sigma squared. That's conditional on knowing the volatility factor theta. And then there is an assumption on the distribution of the joint distribution of the times of observations and the log prices, conditional on knowing theta and conditional on the history. The next observation has some density phi. Okay, there is also capital phi here, but that you can usually take to be dt. So there is some, the joint density is a product like this. Normal distribution times some density phi. In the numerical implementation, phi is going to be exponential with some, well, exponential given theta with some intensity n, which can depend on theta. Okay? So just remember from this slide that there is a rho, which is the underlying normal distribution, and then there is a phi, which is related to the, and the product phi rho is the density of the joint density of the times and the observations of stock prices. Okay, another heavy notation slide, but that's probably the last one. So what we want to compute is called pi t of f, which is conditional expectation of some given function f of your theta, of your volatility factor theta, given the observations. In order there are some explicit formulas. I'll try to give a little bit of description what's going on here. What we need in computation of this filter is something we call structure functions, ck and ck bar. You don't have to look in detail what they are, but there are some kind of conditional expected values of that density thing, rho times phi, and times the function that we are trying to estimate. The point is that these structure functions can be computed, and we compute them using Monte Carlo, and they can be computed offline. They can be computed before you start looking at the data once and for all. Okay, so it's computationally, it's not a problem in terms of how quickly you can do it online. And then there is here two different formulas for the filter. Namely, there is the first formula is the estimates or whatever you're trying to estimate the function of volatility at the times of observations. Okay? And in this case, you get a recursive formula. The estimate at time of observation tk plus 1 is recursively obtained from the observations at previous times. It's really, if you did something like this in discrete time, you would get something like this. It's just like a standard, it's similar to common filter in discrete time. So if it's high frequency data, this is really enough, because why would you need anything in between if it's really high frequency observations? On the other hand, if it's not high frequency observations and you do want estimates of your volatility in between the observations, then there is a filtering equation which actually turns out to be ordinary differential equation. It looks complicated here because of the notation, but it's an ordinary differential equation. So this is one of the rare instances when you're trying to be more realistic, but you get an easier result, because if you know filtering, nonlinear filtering, when you assume that you continuously observe a continuous diffusion process, then you get stochastic PDEs as a filtering equation. But here, because we are assuming that which is more realistic, that we are assuming discretely this continuous process, we actually get an ODE. Now, in the numerical implementation, we are not going to be using this, solving this ODE. We are just doing recursively the filtering at discrete times of observations. Okay. So this is the main result in the theoretical paper. The rest of the paper is about 15 pages of the proof. Now I'm going to skip that, maybe give a sketch of the proof if you have time at the end, maybe not. So I think I mentioned all of these. So those structure functions can be computed offline, recursion for the estimates at observation times, and it's an ODE between the observation times. Okay, so the main example, the one that we implemented in the numerical paper, is when we simply put the volatility equal to this underlying factor theta. We just call it V then. So you have a V is volatility, it's a continuous time Markov chain, which jumps between possible states. Okay. And the states of the Markov chain are called A's, AI's, and then we need to specify transition probabilities of the Markov chain between the states. And what those structure functions reduce to, in this case, is this function here. You have to compute offline by simulation this type of expected value. Okay, we are using, so the times between observations are exponential with intensity n of v. It can depend on volatility. Okay. So something like this, it's easy enough to compute by Monte Carlo. And then the formula from the previous theorem reduces to something like this in this notation. Okay. So this is the filtering formula. This is a formula in particular case when we are estimating the probability that we are at state AI, that the volatility is at state I at time tau k of at time at the kth time of observation. The recursive formula from previous observations. Okay, so the bottom line is the general theory is kind of complicated, but if you specify it to a model like this, which seems like the most natural model, you get a simple recursive procedure. Okay, I'll keep the sketch of the proof for now. So let me now go to the numerical implementation, which is the second paper we did. So what does it? If you know the parameters of your Markov chain, then it just needs some kind of discrete approximation of your continuous time Markov chain, and you need to Monte Carlo simulate those structure functions. And I'll come back to how we decide which state the volatility can go to, the transition probabilities and things like that. I'll come back to that in a second. But let's now just assume that we have somehow estimated the Markov chain of volatility, and then we want to do the filtering side. And I'll just illustrate our initial numerical test just to see that what we are doing makes sense on simulated data. Actually, originally, when we did this, it was not making sense, and then we discovered an error in the formula. So it's always good to do some tests on the simulated data first. So we looked at a couple of test scores. This one is a likelihood ratio test score, and pi there is some kind of reference probability. The most natural thing is to take pi as your prior probability for the Markov chain, and then p in the numerator in the log are posterior probabilities once you start estimating the probabilities of being in a certain state. So this likelihood ratio score is between 0 and 1, and 0 is bad and 1 is good. So I'll show you a graph in the next slide. But all the other tests that you can try to see how good the filter is doing, you can just look at the probability that your estimate is at state AJ. It says the volatility is at state AJ, while the actual probability is at state AI. Okay. So if you look at the matrix of these probabilities, you would like this matrix to be close to unit matrix, once on the diagonal and zeros otherwise, then you are doing perfect estimation. Okay, so in the later slides, I will have also sometimes this matrix just to show how approximately how well the filter is doing. Okay, so this is for the first test, the likelihood ratio test. This was in a case, just a test case, where when you simulate a model with two different values of volatility. So white is bad. No, I'm sorry. White, the lighter color is good, and the black is bad. What happens here is, if you have these two different values of volatility, and then we change these values, and the worst case is when they become equal, because then you can't, or close to each other, then you can't distinguish between those. That's that white star there. That's the worst case. But if you go a little bit away from that, the filter is doing okay, just looking by eye here. Okay, so here is just a simple, is that big enough? Simple simulation when we use the two values for volatility. This is like maybe light gray and white. So this is higher value volatility and this is lower value. These bars tell you where the volatility is changing. So this is the simulated process, and this is the estimation of the posterior probabilities whether we are in state one or state two. And you can't really distinguish by a naked eye where the volatility is changing if you didn't know that, but the filter is doing a pretty good job of saying, okay, with probability one, we are at this state, or with probability zero, we are at that state. Okay, so this is just the probability for one of the states. The filter is following pretty correctly what's going on. Then we did some robustness tests. There is this parameter mu, the return rate of the stock, which we know is hard to estimate, and we are not trying to do it. But so we just did the test, and actually also theoretically, you can show that at least when the intensity of observations go to infinity, when you have more and more observations, then the dependence on mu gets lower and lower, and it's asymptotically independent of the values of the return rate. So that's good feature of the filter. In the simulation, we needed for this dependence to not to matter, we needed about several dozen of observations between jumps of volatility from one value to another. And then we also did a test on a change point problem type of thing where volatility is one value and then jumps to another value, just to see how many observations does the filter need to recognize that there has been a change in volatility. In a particular simulation, we typically get something like this. If this change in volatility is by a factor of two, we need less than 10 observations for the filter to realize there has been a change in volatility. On the other hand, if you have something like a factor very close to 1, like 19 over 20, then we need of the order of 100 observations for the filter to realize there has been a change in volatility. Okay, so that's just describing different tests that we did before we try to apply it to real data. But this filtering thing really comes as the last step of the whole numerical procedure, namely, before we apply it, we need to decide the parameters of our Markov chain, which is the which values for the state of volatility are we going to use, which transition probabilities, and which intensities. Intensities are transition probabilities. And what we used here is so-called multiscale trend analysis, which was done by one of the co-authors on the numerical paper, Zalyapin and his co-authors, in a journal on fractals, I think. Zalyapin was in a geosciences department at UCLA, so he was using this method for applications, the geosciences. So let me tell you roughly how this works. It's a simple idea in principle. So the idea is to try to find a process which at least approximately the change in that process would be proportional to the value of the volatility. If we know exactly how that proportionality looks like, then we can just look at changes of that process to see, and then look at the historical data of the prices and see which values of volatility were relevant. Okay. It turns out that in this model with the diffusion with the stochastic volatility, the right process to look at is simply this kind of first order differences. You look at the differences of log prices, absolute values, and you add them up. And then we have a theoretical result on the following slides, which says that if you look at the differences of such a process, so just the first order absolute differences, then it's approximately, as intensity of the observations m goes to infinity, it's approximately, okay, the time interval times the value of volatility and the square root of the intensity over 2. Okay. So now we know exactly how the volatility looks like relative to this process of first order differences, and then we can look at historically at this process and just look at the slope of that process and decide which values of volatility might be a good values to take as the state of the volatility Markov chain process. So let me show you a graph. So what is this? So the first slide is just a log price. This is simulated data still. So there is a log prices with two values of volatility changes. So there's gray and white. That's where the volatility changes. Then we look at this process P, which is the first order absolute differences. And then we do a linear approximation to that process, and just look at the slopes of the linear pieces. And then from the previous formula, from that proposition, we for each linear piece, we know exactly which volatility value corresponds to that. And then we combine those, look at those volatility values, and get histograms of those volatility values. And you can see that in this case, you get histograms around basically two values, and those are very close to the actual two values that we used in simulation. Okay? So these histograms are just looking at the linear approximation of the first order differences, the slopes. You find a histogram of those values, turns out to be two, and then if you actually compare the estimated values of volatility with the actual values of volatility where it was changing, it's almost agrees almost perfectly. Oh yeah, it's P is just the first order differences of log prices. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so the first one is log prices. The second one is P. Which is the first order differences, and together with the linear approximation, which looks very similar to the actual process, and then we use this theoretical fact that so if you have a linear component in P, then the slope is this. So if you know the slope, you know the value of V of volatility. Okay. So we look at historically, we have a number of intervals where we split this into piecewise linear functions, all those slopes, and then we put all those values of slopes into, we just find histograms for those values. And these histograms are concentrated around two values, which were actually the correct values that we used in simulation. Okay? Now, you could actually kind of maybe be happy with this and stop here. And say, well, this is how I'm going to estimate the volatility. Why do I need? What we are going to do is we are just using this as the first step to get the possible values of volatility. And then now we're going to, on top of that, and we're going to do filtering. we did some in the numerical paper at the end. We show that filtering does help. It reduces the error. Now, if it look, it's a question of what you need to do this for, whether you, it's worth doing the filtering above this. You could just kind of do this. But the error is smaller if you do filtering at top of this. Okay? Any other comments or questions? Okay, so a little bit more precisely how this MTA procedure works. This is, there is no rigorous theory for this part. The filtering was rigorous theory. This is a little bit ad hoc, but there is some systematic way to do it. So one question is, how do you decide on this linear approximation of the P process, and how many intervals you're going to have different piecewise linear components? Because there's a trade-off. You don't want to have too many or too few. If it's too many, you have too ragged picture. Too few, it's not good either. So roughly speaking, how it works, you kind of do an iterative procedure. You look at the quadratic error. First, you approximate the whole thing just by one line. It's just regression. Okay? So L0 is just one line, and you look at the quadratic error. And then, now you're gonna, I did just one interval, right? Now, my next step is gonna be maybe 5 intervals, or maybe 10 intervals. How do I decide what is the next step? Well, we use this criterion. You look at the log of the new error relative to the error with only one line, and divide by the number of intervals. So here is a trade-off of the number of intervals and the error, and then so we maximize that, optimize that over n, and that's how we choose the next. Okay, so we start with one line, then maybe we go to 5, 15, 18, whatever this iterative optimization procedure gives you. Okay, this comes from we try different things. So there is no strict theorem that says this is the optimal criterion to do. This is comes from information theory, and it seems to work well in this case. So let me show you a picture. So when do we stop is the question. If you continue doing this, you'll eventually have infinitely many intervals. So when you graph the number of segments that you're going to be using for your linear approximation of these differences versus the error, actually I think it's a log error, then typically what you see is kind of a change in slope from this slope to this one. So what we do, we basically use the numbers that come up where the change of slope is happening. That shows you where it's the critical value. So the previous picture that I showed you, this one, was done with the one boundary or that interval where the slope is changing. Okay, so that was done on the left boundary here. And then to check for robustness, we did it in the other boundary, and this is the picture for the other boundary. So now we are doing more. We are splitting, when you did this piecewise linear thing, we split into more intervals, and we get histograms which are not as concentrated, but they are still doing a pretty good job. Okay. So again, there is no theory behind this. It's just doing this and seeing, okay, it seems to work. So it's the same data, but the histograms are a little bit more spread out because we used more intervals when we did this approximation. So we got more values for volatilities. Okay. So just to recap where we are standing, what is the complete algorithm now? We are going to use this now both on simulated data and IBM and General Electric. So the first thing to do is actually what I just described. You have to estimate the possible volatility values, and I just described how to do that. Then you choose according to your histograms. You have to group into, you know, have to choose some values. That's again a little bit arbitrary. But then once you did all of that, now you have your parameters for the Markov chain, and then you can do the filtering. Okay, so show you some slides. What happens with first it's similar. Well, for General Electric, what happened is we have this was daily data for a number of years. We you will see the histograms. It kind of turns out it's about three values of volatility, roughly about 6%, 10%, 15% seem to be relevant values of volatility. But let me first show you the graphs for simulated data, which always looks better, of course, than real data. So because both with IBM data and with General Electric data, we got three values for volatility as possible values. So we did a simulation also with three values. So there is a white, gray, and darker gray. So the simulated log prices are in the first graph. And then this graph is estimated probabilities for two of the states. The third is just one minus those two. Okay. So this is a simulated data. The filter is doing a pretty good job at being pretty certain whether you are at one of these values or not. So it's either close to zero or close to one, these probabilities. If you look at the histogram, you get three histograms pretty clearly, which are centered around close to around the actual volatility values that we used in simulation. And if you look at that matrix of probabilities of being right or wrong, it's close enough to identity matrix. But again, this was simulated data. We knew what the volatility values were. We used the actual model that on which the theory was based. Okay. But let's look at the. Okay, so this is General Electric's daily data from 1960 to 2005 almost. So this is how these are two histograms on the two. You get a picture like this, and so one histogram corresponds to this one, and one histogram to this. In this MTA procedure, when you decide how finely you will estimate the first order differences. Well, now it doesn't look that good, but we decided this represents three volatility values. And those are the ones that I mentioned before, 6%, 10%, and 15%. So you get histograms like this in terms of pre-estimating possible volatility values. Okay, so now we are going to decide that there is only three possible volatility values, 6, 15, and 10%. And then we do the filtering. So the filter probability, again, for two of those values are in the first slide. Well, at many instances, the filter seems pretty certain what's going on, but then there is also now a number of places where the filter is confused and gives probability around a half or not close to one or zero, which of the three values is being currently the volatility. Not going to comment on those two. This is just this is just showing that higher value of volatilities. These are the values of the first order differences. Some of the first order, just higher value of volatilities correspond to higher value of first order differences. That's to be expected. And then finally, this is. So General Electric data was daily data. And this is IBM high-frequency data during one day. And so we were motivated by the idea that we would use this on high-frequency data. But actually, it works better with daily data, at least in these samples. For IBM data, we get a histogram. High-frequency data for IBM, we get histogram like that. And we did filtering with then four possible values of volatility, but whether it's four or not here, it's not that clear. So I guess why does it look worse with the high frequency data? Well, probably because once you look at high frequency, which is here is the data, it looks less like a diffusion. So maybe the model is not as good really to use a diffusion model. Maybe you need some jumps and Lavi processes. This is again, we didn't pursue this. Again, this is something that I think some people are filtering experts have been working on with their students, and, but I don't know that there are any papers yet to include jumps in the model for the stock prices. this was the data. This was our estimated four values of volatility, if you believe that it is four values of volatility that's going on here. Okay, I could go back to that sketch of the proof, but maybe would you like to see that or not? I'll do the conclusions and go back quickly to that proof if you are interested. So conclusions, we have a efficient algorithm for estimating current volatility values, which is robust with respect to drift. Some generalizations and weaknesses. We don't predict volatility in the future. We just estimate current volatility. Another extension would be when volatility would depend on the value of the asset. In our case, it's independent, driven by independent Brownian motion or independent Markov chain. And the third one I just mentioned is it looks like, at least for high frequency data, it would maybe help if you introduce jumps in your model. Okay, but since we do have 5 minutes for the mathematicians in the audience, just quick sketch of the main theoretical proof. So you have this basically a point process. Your observations are this pair of the times of observations and the observations themselves, tau k, x k. That's what your data is. So you look at the counting measure, which is called mu, of that point process. And then we want to compute the compensator of that counting process. Which is defined by this expression for all test functions phi. Okay. So it turns out it can be computed in this case, and that's why the whole thing works. So first of all, in general, that compensator of a counting measure like that is known to be of this form. This is a joint distribution over 1 minus distribution of the observation times. And then the crucial lemma is that under the assumptions on this joint distribution, if you remember, there was this density phi times rho, which was the normal density, we can actually compute, and it's not hard to compute this compensator, and it looks, it's in the notation of those structure functions that I gave you very early on. Okay? But this is actually not such a complicated computation to go from here to here. So we compute compensator of the counting measure. Why does that help? And then you get this theorem, which really immediately will produce the theorem, the main filtering formulas. It says that the filter equation in the integral form is the filter of the L is just the generator of the just Itô's rule, just the generator of the underlying diffusion process. But then the hard part is the martingale part. So that's the dt part, and then you have a martingale part. The martingale here is integral with respect to the counting measure minus the compensator. Compensator is defined so that this thing is a martingale, integral of this thing is a martingale. Okay. And then the main problem is, so basically, first you show that the difference between the filter and the Itô's part is a martingale. That's standard. That's not hard. But then you actually have to compute how that martingale looks like. It's a martingale representation theorem in this general context for point processes. And because we were able to compute the compensator, we can actually also compute the integrand in this Martingale integral, and that integrand is what gives you the formula for the filter. This is very briefly a 10-page proof in one slide, but it's kind of a relatively standard filtering or nonlinear filtering proof applied on this two-dimensional point process. So I'll stop here.